Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University. Today, Sam, my colleague, is away, so I'll be handling the show myself. Today, we're going to talk about American conservatism and American politics in a turbulent moment. President Trump has, many agree, upended many of the conventions and routines and ideas of Washington, and some have argued that we are entering into a period that is turbulent and chaotic, and the future unfolds without much certainty. Republicans are at war with themselves, some think. The media is feeling as if they are in a battle with the administration, and many Democrats are trying to figure out what to do next. And one of the questions that's front and center is what's happening with American conservatism in the era of Trump? What impact will this have on the movement, on the ideas that have been around since the 1970s, and on the Republican Party? Today, our guest is David Frum, a writer who writes for The Atlantic and has emerged as one of the most vocal critics of the Trump administration. He served in the White House of George W. Bush as a speechwriter, and he's written for many publications, including The Week, The Daily Beast, The Weekly Standard, The National Review, The Wall Street Journal. He also appears frequently on television, including CNN, and he is currently finishing up a book, which I believe is titled Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic, which will be released in January. So it's great to have you on the show.
Julian, thank you. Thank you for that introduction, which is the nicest possible way of saying I can't hold down a job. So I really appreciate the elegant way that you glided through that minefield.
I see it as doing many jobs well. And speaking of that, I remember years ago now, I read your book. I think I was in graduate school or finishing graduate school in the 1970s. And you argued, you were one of the first to really argue, we have to look at that decade and it had consequences. And you argued a lot of our contemporary political and social life grew out of that decade. Do you think that's still true?
Oh, I think it looks stronger than ever. Like the central idea of that book was that I'm born in 1960, and people of my age and a little bit older remember the America of the 1950s and 60s as normal, and then the things that came after as abnormal. And Donald Trump speaks to that with his promise to bring back that period. And the idea of my 70s history was that the United States that people of my age and older remembered was forged by the emergencies of the middle of the 20th century. The United States is in pretty much a constant state of war or near war from 1917 to 1989. And in order to wage wars cold and hot and to get through the depression that was in the middle of it, the United States built a society that was very different from the kind of society the United States had been before 1917 and very different from the society that was coming into being after 1989. And so the argument of the 1970s book was stop being nostalgic for this middle period, which has many attractive features, but understand it was forged by emergencies that aren't going to return, and that you can't say, well, I liked the social equality of the period, but I disliked the militarization and conscription of the period, because the two went hand in hand. Mm-hmm. World War I is not formally ended until 1974. And that's the year in which it finally becomes legal for American citizens again to own a gold bar, which to that point had been quite a serious crime.
And so the 1970s then, it's a transition. And this is when the conservative movement comes of age. And what is it about the ideas that come out of that decade, this new period that you thought were influential in the era of Ronald Reagan and everything we lived through between the 80s and 90s?
So the movement we called American conservatism, like all movements, political movements, is made out of bits and pieces that accrete together for reasons of history and personality. You know, opposition to the New Deal, opposition to the civil rights movement, many, many things. But nothing there is strong enough to become a majority. What makes the conservative movement that we knew in the Reagan period a majority is the shock of the system failures of the 1970s. The reason that period is so crucial is because that's the period where the New Deal, World War II solutions really obviously stop working as well as they had worked to that point. So to put it bluntly, movement conservatism, Ronald Reagan conservatism, is a collection of answers to the problems of the 1970s, which conservatives then implemented in whole or in part over the next 20 years, many of which worked extremely well, some of which worked less well, but which eventually ran out of steam because either they solved the problems that had called them into being, or they failed to solve the problems that had called them into being, in which case who needed the answers, and the exam changed. To this day,
when did the exam change? When does the exam change?
The exam begins to change after about 1995. Mm-hmm. So from 75 to 95, that's the heroic age of American conservatism. Inflation, we know how to stop it. Slow productivity growth because of overregulation, we know how to get the transportation and energy sector. Oh, fuel shortages, boy. Got that 100% on that one. Crime, we know what to do about that. An ideological nuclear superpower enemy. Yeah, ready for all of those things. So those things get implemented between about 1975 and 1995, and like all human contrivances, they work imperfectly, but in some cases better, some cases worse. Then the problems change. Then some of the solutions turn out to have problems of their own. So it turns out, the United States has this terrible crime wave that gets going in the early 1960s and comes to a culmination in the early 1990s, and conservatives stop it mostly by putting a lot of people in prison. And that worked. You stop the crime by putting a lot of people in prison. And then you take your pulse and you say, you know what? It worked, but having a lot of people in prison is also an enormous problem. And I said, well, what if we put some more in? No, that will make it worse, not better. Yeah. And after a while, you know, do we want to drive – and we could put drive the crime rate to zero by putting everybody in prison. But there comes a point where we say, you know, maybe we've overdone this a little bit. And that is what begins to happen in the middle 1990s and with accelerating force after 9/11 and 2005, conservatism – basically, as the old trade unionists warned, has worked itself out of a job.
And where does – so you worked in the Bush White House, that George W. Bush. Yeah. Where does his presidency fit? Because it obviously comes in this key period.
The Bush presidency was a period where a couple things happened. First, at home, we tried to re-implement one more time familiar solutions, hoping that they would have the effect. So George W. Bush does another set of big tax cuts in 2001, 2003, hoping to recapitulate the effect of 1981 and 1986 when there were similar big tax cuts. Only they don't yield the same results as the Reagan tax cuts did. And economists will argue about why that's so, but the fact that they didn't is pretty indisputable. George W. Bush inherited, he didn't do the financial deregulation, but he was there as it went into effect. It was signed into law by Bill Clinton and advocated by many of the people in the Clinton world, only to discover that deregulating finance is not the same thing, whereas deregulating oil and gas, everyone I think now would say that was clearly the right thing to do. Transportation, I mean, there are some problems. It had an impact on the wages of people who work in those sectors, but clearly a huge no one would rethink about re-regulating trucking, re-regulating rail, those things that were signed into law by Jimmy Carter for the most part, but advocated by the conservative movement of the 1970s. But the deregulation of finance after the middle 1990s was pretty obviously a calamity. And the lessons you learned in those other areas didn't work. And so it went that the welfare reform that conservatives advocated in the middle 1990s and became law and did put many people back into the workforce, which was a positive thing. But as the labor sector of the economy stagnated in the Bush years, you also began to see that some of the promises of the welfare reform in the middle 1990s, which is we just get people back to work. It doesn't matter how crummy the first job is because the next one will be better. Mm-hmm. And they'll develop habits of work and stability. Actually, no, that didn't. What happened was we spread low wages through the economy, and a lot of people who had been in what had once been solidly middle-class jobs who continued to perform more or less the same jobs found this instead of the welfare – formerly welfare population seeing a rising standard of living and increasingly stable family structures, what we saw was people who had been in what were middle-class jobs seeing falling standards of living and decreasingly stable mm-hmm. household patterns.
And then where does national security fit?
That's a place where they changed the exam most radically. Mm-hmm. Cold War ends, triumphant moment of up democratization everywhere, and not just in the Cold War places, but in places like Mexico that becomes a multi-party democracy. It's all, I mean, within 6 months of the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's an amazing, if you remember it. I mean, it's
unbelievable moment.
You'll never have a happier public moment in your life, probably, than the 6 months on either side of November 1989. You'll never see anything as beautiful as that again. I was watching a clip. I'm working on a documentary with some friends about these themes, and I was watching. They found a clip of Tom Brokaw. He's weeping at the Berlin Wall. Mm-hmm. And you had to have seen the thing when it was up to know what it meant to see it come down.
I mean,
So the goal then was to say, okay, so now here is our chance to do what was done in Japan and Western Europe after 1945, to do it in more places. I wouldn't say it was a failure exactly. It worked in some places. I mean, things are clearly better in Taiwan and better in South Korea and better in Chile. But a lot of places it didn't work, and it's been going backward now since 2000. Literally, 2005 is the inflection point where we're seeing de-democratization in a lot of the places that were up-democratized in 1989.
And so then in the middle of George W. Bush, we have obviously the Obama presidency, but you also have the Tea Party movement.
Right.
And you wrote, I found in the Daily Beast, you wrote back in 2013, Tea Party extremism contaminated the whole Republican brand. And you went on to talk about some of the impact Sarah Palin and others had. Can you talk now, again, in retrospect, how important was that 2010 to 2014 period?
Look, I was a big supporter of the Iraq War. So in some ways, I live in a state of karmic imbalance with the universe. But I say that just so – because whenever you're about to talk about something that you got right, you need to talk about the things you got wrong. But I saw this thing – I mean, that so many people I knew saw the Tea Party. This is it. This is the burst of energy. This is going to revive the Republican Party. This is the libertarian moment that we've been dreaming of. So I went to a lot of Tea Party events. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like that at all. It was two things. That most of the people – who were there to defend Medicare from Obamacare. And a number of the people who were there as part of a rising sense of radicalized displacement, ethnic, cultural, that were ill at ease. And the for a lot of people, the Medicare was a very concrete worry, and for some people, it was a symbolic worry. And there are people with weapons, openly displayed, which was a new thing in the 2010s, for people to bring openly displayed pseudo-military weapons with them. And to wear pseudo-military camouflage. I had never seen that at a political event before 2010. Maybe it's happening and I didn't know, but I'd never seen it. Suddenly you're seeing it a lot, but not like now. Now people are coming in not only in uniforms and pseudo-military weapons, but they're actually forming tactical formations, taking up pseudo-military positioning. That's what we saw at Charlottesville. Yeah. And when the San Antonio City Council voted about removing their Confederate War memorials. I mean, people took up tactical formations around the council chamber. And again, they didn't point the weapons. That's illegal in Texas, but they had the weapons at the ready. And you saw those things. And this is not – whatever this is not a mass movement in favor of the Ryan Plan. Now, they are not here. They are not here because they want the budget deficit to be smaller.
Yeah. Where was it coming from?
It was coming from the defense of Medicare. What we have seen in all the developed countries, more and less in places like Canada and Germany and Australia, more in the United States, France, England, are the French have a very useful phrase: acquired rights. So free speech, that's the freedom of worship. Those are inherent natural rights. A 6-week pension, a 6-week summer holiday, and a pension that starts at 62. That's an acquired right. Obviously, God didn't decide that we should have those things. But once you have them, you become very, very attached to them.
Yeah.
And then when people start to take them away, you form movements in defense of these acquired rights. Well, Medicare is an acquired right. It's a really comfortable social insurance program that is available to certain people in the American state based on age. Its financial outlook is dodgy. And a lot of the people who either are in it or even more, this is the center of the Tea Party, soon to qualify, 2, 3, 4 years away, who are in the early 60s, who've gone through this terrible trauma of the Great Recession, who remember 9/11 and the massive failure of government that they saw on that day, that they see in Obamacare an attack on their acquired right with a view to redistributing it to other people who are going to be different from them. They're not wrong about that, by the way. Obamacare did purport to finance itself with a reduction in the future growth of Medicare, a very substantial reduction in the future growth. And they're not wrong that the beneficiaries were different. 25% of the people who lacked health insurance in the United States on the eve of the Affordable Care Act going into effect were foreign – actually, more than 25% were foreign-born. So that placard that – I don't know if it was ever carried non-ironically – at a rally, keep the government's hands off the Medicare. If anyone, I mean, there are photographs of people with the placard, but they're like pranksters. But if anybody ever carried that placard non-ironically, they were not stupid, because who else's hands were going to touch your Medicares other than the government's? And it wasn't that the person didn't know that Medicare came from the government. He was fighting to prevent the government from taking it away again.
Yeah. And so that – more that than a response to Obama or
What was happening with Obamacare was a president whom these people thought was alien was threatening a program that they needed much more than they thought they were going to 20 years before in order to benefit people whom they thought of as alien. And so as society becomes more diverse, economic redistribution inevitably becomes ethnic redistribution.
Mm-hmm. And then we get to President Trump. So the Tea Party seems relevant just because
– it's absolutely relevant.
Like, it changes the tenor of the party before this election.
A lot of people bought into the idea that the Tea Party movement was a Paul Ryan movement.
So, right.
Well, where are the Tea Party Republicans going to go? Trump is the Tea Party.
Right.
Trump is the guy who figured out what the Tea Party really wanted and then gave it to them. Ryan was the guy who tried to ride the Tea Party in a direction exactly the opposite from the direction which – the Tea Party wanted to go. And because most people don't think very ideologically, for a time that sort of works if you give them the right kind of feelings about it. But they do eventually figure out, wait a minute, I'm here because I want more health care and less immigration. And you're offering me more immigration and less health care.
Mm-hmm. And right. And so then before we get to where we are today, 2016 November comes and why – or let's say back in the summer, why do the Republicans go as a whole with the Tea Party candidate or with the unconventional candidate as opposed to the other superstars on the table?
Well, why they don't go with the own ticket is has to do with Trump figured out what they wanted. I mean, the Republican Party has been a coalition of the people who are the biggest winners from globalization and the people who are the biggest losers from globalization on the deal that the losers will provide the votes and the winners will provide the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
That was unstable. But once Trump secured the nomination, then he goes on to the rest of the way because this is a great day for political science. I mean, this is a real world test of a political science proposition of negative partisanship. What if you have a candidate who has nothing to do with any of the affirmative program of a political party, who can only campaign on dislike for the other political party entirely? Would that work?
Yes. Looks like it did.
So, yes, it will.
Yeah. So you don't associate him with conservatism.
Well, it isn't that I don't. I'm not one of those people who says why there is a true conservative which exists inside a crystalline case somewhere that is not sullied by the vulgarities of the marketplace. Look, conservatism is what conservatives do, and conservatives have rallied to him except for a few, you know, thought leaders who are not thought leaders because no one's following, but a few intellectuals and a few politicians. The conservative world has followed him. So he is functionally a conservative. But pretty obviously, he has none of the content. I mean, he's performing it. On the day we record, there is a little incident where President Trump's son, Donald Jr., tweeted some abuse of the actress Jane Fonda and referred to her as Hanoi Jane in a mocking way. Something from how long ago was that?
Right.
So what is Jane Fonda's offense? She traveled to Vietnam in, I think, 1969, and she allowed herself to be photographed with prisoners of war, which is a violation of the Geneva Convention. And that's not very, very good. Although she didn't say anything against them or didn't accuse them of crimes, that's not good. Donald Trump literally ridiculed not only a POW, but all POWs by saying it's bad to get captured, like sort of like Joseph Stalin's approach to prisoners. You know, you shoot them because they should have. It's a performance of a kind of conservative – it's a conservative performance but minus the content. I mean they so little understand what the content is. So, the reason people were mad at Jane Fonda
So he's parroting some of the language.
Of the affect. It's the affect, but the content is gone. But look, it works. I mean, that most people call themselves conservative will, to one degree or another, defend Donald Trump, either on his own merits or at least is better than, you know, the unthinkable alternative.
And when you see Stephen Bannon make his speech a few days ago talking about, you know, this – I don't remember the exact words, but this war – in the GOP and how he's going to go after the establishment. What's your response to how serious this is? Is there really the threat?
The thing that he's describing is extremely serious. Mm-hmm. Bannon himself is not. We were talking about this a little earlier today, that Ralph Nader had this trick. Whenever he found out the government was about to do something at 4 o'clock, he would call a press conference at noon and demand that the government do the thing it was going to do at 4 o'clock. So that's what Bannon sort of shows up 4 hours before an event happens. Yeah. So, it's not because of Bannon that Moore beat Strange in Alabama. Bannon contributed nothing to that. But he saw the way the wind was blowing. And more astutely than Donald Trump, he had different motives and different incentives, but he put himself into the winning side and then claimed credit, although it had nothing to do with him. And Moore is it's hard to imagine a better known person in the state of Alabama. Alabamans have strong views, and they also have strong reasons for rejecting the traditional Republican leadership in the state, which has been very tainted through a series of financial and sexual scandals. They had good reason to reject the more normal Republican. But that conflict between the failure of the more normal Republican Party to take seriously the interests of its voters and the temptation then of those voters to park their faith with cranks and oddballs and sinister people of all kinds. That's something that – I mean, Steve Bannon could tomorrow decide to enjoy his Seinfeld residuals quietly for the rest of his life. That would not stop.
So one issue is within the Republican Party, you have these tensions that have been brewing now for a while, and they're playing out. Stephen Bannon might jump in, but it's not about him. But then the second issue seems to be the relationship of the GOP to President Trump.
Yes.
From the Russia investigation to all the chaos that we see on a daily basis. Do you think there's any change going on in the GOP's loyalty to the president?
Well, I don't know that loyalty is the right word.
Okay.
I think there probably can be very few people who hate him as much as Mitch McConnell.
Despite the photo.
And probably with a richness and depth and detail that most of us can barely begin to imagine. Mm-hmm. But the McConnell-Trump relationship is like that old joke about the bank, that if you owe the bank $1,000, you have a problem. And if you owe the bank $100 million, they have a problem. And so that the Republican Party relationship with Trump is based on the fact that they're beholden to him on a huge scale. They can't get rid of him. And what he understood, because I can never decide whether I want to say this is he knows things that he doesn't understand or understands things that he doesn't know, but in a non-rationalized way, Trump's among his great skills is his ability to detect where the balance of weakness lies in any human relationship. And he figured out they need him. It doesn't look that way. Normally, the president needs Congress more than Congress needs the president. This is an exception. They need him more than he needs them, because he doesn't want to enact anything. If you want to pass laws, you need Congress. And given the historic superior incumbent protection of Congress, they get to stay there, whether they do nothing. And the president takes the blame. But in this case, he doesn't care what he passes. He's no interest in legislation. And meanwhile, they do care a lot. They have a lot of things they want to pass. And meanwhile, he's very vulnerable. I mean, he's vulnerable in the sense that his vulnerabilities accrete to them. I think he also may intuit, if and when the Republicans lose one or both chambers of Congress, he'll be stronger relative to the party, not weaker, because he'll then be the only Republican symbol. And he'll become then the target of all the Democratic anger against all the things that United Republican control has been doing, and he will then benefit from negative partisanship even more strongly.
Do you think there's that? Do you think there's a strategy in the Trump mind, or
no? But I think there are.
It's instinct.
Yeah, I think there are things he just as I don't know whether to say he knows it or understands it.
Yeah.
But he just he's canny. He's canny most of all when he's in trouble and on defense. So no, it's not strategic, and partly because he doesn't have political goals. He has psychic goals.
What do you mean?
George W. Bush wanted to get a bunch of things done, and he wanted to be remembered in a certain kind of way. And Barack Obama the same way. And Barack Obama actually had an even bigger agenda than George W. Bush. What Donald Trump wants is to be dominant in the moment. And if he could be dominant posthumously, that would be – I mean if there were like a big pyramid that blocked traffic somewhere and inconvenienced people, that would be even better. But okay, he doesn't – but what he wants is to be dominant in the moment. So long as he gets that, he doesn't care what the thing that passes through Congress is. So long as it is the Obama Sucks Act of 2017, it could ratify like 96 things that President Obama actually did. He wouldn't care, just so long as it's clear that Obama is dragged down and he is elevated up.
Are you ever surprised? I mean, you're a very smart commentator. You write about this for a long time, that in the White House right now is someone of the nature you describe and someone who you've written really has done things that threaten our institutions. How did we get here? I mean, how are we in this place where this almost becomes normal on a daily basis?
Well, look, I think one of the things that keeps me going, I never lose my sense of the hideousness of it and the wrongness of it. That's just with me. All the time. I mean, I have never set foot inside the Trump Hotel. I try to avoid the area around Lafayette Square and the White House. I don't even want to look at it. I remember going to an event at the White House just before the transition and going through the gates and meeting with people I knew. And we disagreed about a lot. But it never struck me as crazy that they were there. Sometimes it was high school sports, blue shirts, red shirts.
Right.
Sometimes if the blue shirts won all the games, the red shirt, why would you play? It never struck me as crazy that Barack Obama was there. I mean, again, disagreed with him a lot, and I can fill the air if we wanted to with my criticisms of him. But this is a thoughtful person, This is a man in command of himself. This is somebody with a sense of responsibility and duty and obligation. Again, maybe even too much, but don't like the Iran deal. But I understand why he did it, and I understand that his motives in doing it were public motives. So you then move from that to what we have now, and I can never get past the sense of wrongness of it. And the world's not functioning. And I use the term world advisedly, because this isn't Belgium. When things go wrong here, they go wrong all over the planet, and that is what we're seeing that happen now. And one of the thing that brought me to the political right in the first place was my concern. Grew up in Canada, beneficiary of the American-led world order. See what it means. Wanted to preserve it, and Donald Trump is damaging that at a rate and with an intensity. I think very few people can bear to compute.
Do you think, and I wonder about this all the time, that we will end up normalizing a lot of this? And like you, I'll appear on a TV show or be interviewed and they'll ask about the latest thing that happened as if it's just today's news, some abnormal event from the White. Do you think as a democracy we might end up normalizing some of what's going on?
I worry about that. If that happens, I think that means a lot will have been – it's like gum disease, right? You lose some gum and you get used to – and then eventually the tooth falls out. But here's where we are moving. I think we're moving to a world in which the United States is going to matter less. I mean that is something that's probably in the cards anyway over the next 50 or 80 years. It's going to go faster. I mean imagine being a concerned and patriotic Japanese citizen. You have to think hard about your security arrangements. The Americans have shown you that they're capable of something. And that's not a lesson you can put out of mind. Ditto for our European friends. I mean, they have to think about, well, the president said he wouldn't defend Estonia if it were attacked by Russia. We have to think about that. That doesn't mean they necessarily do something hugely dramatic right away, but that's a piece of knowledge they don't lose. Just as when it was debated in 2011 whether the United States should pay its debts or not, mm-hmm. people are not going to forget that was a question that was once, what are you talking about? Obviously, of course, there are no two answers here. Well, now there are two. I mean, the balance of decision is on one side. Yes, of course, we probably should. But there are some voices who say maybe we don't have to.
And is this containable? Meaning if the Republicans on the Hill stand still and don't do much for all the reasons you outlined, this adults in the room argument.
The best case scenario.
Yeah.
Best case scenario is it is like gum disease, and we come out, we've kept our teeth, but we have less gum. But the losses will be permanent. Right. They're already there. They're already there. And the worst case scenarios are really quite a bit worse. And it's been hard for me. I just finished this long book about this. And even at the end, the one thing is I'm going through the proofs, and it's really too late to change now, and I wouldn't change probably if I could, but I wonder if I've been quite explicit enough about what I worry about. But a book that had a lot of impact on me as I was working on my own is Daniel Ziblatt's book on conservative parties and the rise of democracy, a book I strongly recommend. It's an amazing piece of scholarship, historical and political science at the same time. But to crudely reduce a really rich and amazingly researched book, this idea is this. When conservative parties, conservative in the broadest sense, that is, the parties that represent people who have more to lose from politics than to gain, if and when conservative parties become convinced that they cannot prevail in democratic competition, they don't give up on conservatism. They give up on democratic competition. Mm-hmm. And I think we are at risk of seeing some of those things happen in the United States now. Voting dirty tricks and voter suppression and changing the hours of polls. And, Americans have been doing that since the advent of elections in this country, to one party doing down the other. But I think what we have seen since 2008 is, in a way that we haven't seen since the Reconstruction era, important parts of the American governing elite said, we may have overdone this universal suffrage business. Mm-hmm. We may have overdone it. We need to roll back on that just a little.
That would be very damaging.
And it's happening. Yeah. It's happening. It has happened. It has happened.
Why do you think there's no outrage about the Russia story? Is it because people don't believe it's true, or there is no outrage about—
Why do you say there's no outrage? I mean—
Do you think there is?
I think there's a lot of outrage. I think it's like a nice family with a child molestation scandal ticking away inside it. The consequences, if it is true— the way some people think it might be true. The consequences are so horrifying. People don't even like to contemplate them, much less pronounce them. So I think that what there is through the world of people who care about these things, a sense of we're looking at something that's potential. I mean, there's the usual partisan crossfire, argy-bargy talking point and dust up in the air. And today was a big day for dust up in the air with, the Clinton Foundation did something with Russia, and maybe it doesn't mean much, but it's something. But over the long haul, you're looking at what may be the most, if all the facts are as they could be, the most successful political espionage operation in the history of the world. That's an uncomfortable thing to think about.
And we'll find that out from the Robert Mueller investigation, potentially.
Potentially.
But it could also unfold in a way that just remains unclear.
Well, we may also have to confront this, and we were talking about this in your class today, that a lot of the worst things that may have happened, we don't say they did, we don't yet know exactly, but that may have, and that every day look more likely to have happened, may not violate any criminal laws. And we are in a world of, there are certainly technical violations of elections law that may have happened. There are violations of disclosure law. There may be some money laundering statutes at issue. But at its core, for a private sector American citizen to work with a foreign intelligence agency against a political rival, that in itself is not illegal. It violates all kinds of other expectations about how the society should be run, but it's not illegal. And if that's what turns out to happen, we're going to have a very painful conversation in this country. But what do you do if people around the president or possibly the president himself are shown to have acted in a way that is anti-democratic, unethical, argue disloyal, but not illegal.
And do you think in terms, and this relates to your own work, so if the 70s led conservatives to form their ideas and to reconfigure their agenda, will the era of Trump, the Trumpocracy, do you think conservatives who still are working within our system and have ambitions to use the Republican Party as a vehicle for political change, how will the conservative movement change after President Trump? And I ask, you're kind of going through this in some ways on the pages.
Yeah. I don't think post-Trump it will make a lot of sense to talk about the conservative movement anymore. I mean, obviously, there are conservative people, there are conservative outlooks, but the conservative movement as it existed from, what, the early 1950s until the early 2000s, I think we're going to need new language because we're talking about something that I mean, there'll be some ghostly continuities, but it's going to be so different. And I think we are, to put it really bluntly, we're moving from an era in which our big argument was what should government do and how should it be paid for to, well, actually, we don't disagree that much about what government should do, but for whom should government do it and who should pay for it? That's going to be the new argument.
Have you been surprised at your role? You are now often seen as one of the most exciting voices from people who are on a different part of the political spectrum.
That is weird. No question, that is weird. And I intend to book time at some point in the future to think about it. But in the meantime, as I said, I live in the state of karmic debt to the universe. And so I have this feeling of, you know, I had this a lot during the Tea Party thing when I was saying many of these same things, but in a way that did not elicit the amazing response that it often seems to get now. And I'm very grateful for that. But there's a decade where I was saying the same things and really literally nobody was interested. Well, my wife would kind of listen, but I don't know how interested she was. But you just have to do it. You can't watch yourself doing it. You can't analyze yourself doing it. You just have to do it. And I'm getting older now, and one of the pieces of political advice I increasingly dispense is you never know when the moment is when you're going to be needed. And it probably will never come. But you can spend a lot of time in politics doing things and wondering why am I doing them, and then you're tempted to take shortcuts or to make compromises, and then one day comes the moment when you're needed, and you say, "Oh, that's what it was all for."
And this is one of those moments. And we are out of time, so I want to thank you again for being on Politics and Polls, David Frum, writer for The Atlantic. New book coming out in January, is that correct?
That's correct.
Trumpocracy, the Corruption of the American Republic. Who's the publisher?
HarperCollins.
HarperCollins, and will be available everywhere, and I am sure widely discussed. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back soon, and Sam will be back on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.